Hello, welcome to the Anarchist Book Club with Jim Yeoman and me, Danny Evans. In this episode, we chat to Sophie Turbutt and Josh Newmark, two specialists on the history of Spanish anarchism, about a conference that they organised together in Leeds. We also ask Sophie and Josh about their recently published articles, which are about, respectively, anarchist advice columns in the magazine La Revista Blanca in the 1930s and Spanish anarchist solidarity with the Mexican Revolution. Before we begin, I'd like to read out a short message from Ryan Roberts, one of the Bristol Kill the Bill prisoners. Ryan is serving a 14-year sentence at HMP Swaleside. You can find out more about how to write to and support those jailed following the Kill the Bill protests in Bristol by checking out Bristol Defendant Solidarity on Twitter and Bristol Anarchist Black Cross at bristolabc.org. All I can say is that if we don't stand up now, they will govern us the way they want society to be run, and we will lose. So stand up now and fight, and we have a chance of winning. Please support the Kill the Bill prisoners in any way you can. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hi, Josh and Sophie. Welcome. Thanks for joining us. If we could just start by asking you like a generic kind of question about how you, like what it is you study and how you came to be interested in Spanish anarchism in the first place.
Firstly, thanks for having us on. I work on internationalism and international solidarity within the Spanish anarchist movement from kind of the foundation of the CNT in 1910 to the end of the Civil War in 1939. So I kind of frame this to paraphrase you guys in terms of placing Spanish anarchism within a broader history of the international left, but I'm aiming to do that from the movement's own perspective. So how did they understand themselves as part of an international left in terms of their kind of allies around the world, and also the history, the global history of working class struggle. And I came to this, I think, from an interest in revolutionary movement, increasingly from an anti-authoritarian perspective, and an interest in the Spanish Civil War. I think a lot of people who are interested in 20th century history are drawn to the Spanish Civil War because of the whole idea of this clash between anarchism, communism, fascism, socialism, and all the rest. And also time living in Spain also made me quite interested in working academically on Spanish history, and this particular topic I came to through studying the impact of the Russian Revolution on Spanish anarchists. So my master's thesis looked at the kind of legacy of the Russian Revolution and how Spanish anarchists viewed the Soviet Union in the 1930s.
Yeah, so again, yeah, like Josh said, thank you for welcoming both of us onto the podcast today. So my research is essentially on anarchist womanhood. I look specifically through framing this in terms of interpersonal relationships between anarchist women and other people. So, you know, romantic relationships, parent-child relationships, teacher-student relationships, things like that, to try and better understand the sort of gender dynamics of anarchist political culture in Spain. I came to this, I mean, if I try and put a finger on it, I think it kind of began through a seminar I did on during my Erasmus year. So I studied abroad in Spain. I spent time in Spain, just like Josh, where we looked at La Novela Ideal, which is, you know, an anarchist series of short stories. And I just thought it was a really interesting primary source. And so when I was sort of sitting down thinking what I want to do my master's on, having done an undergrad dissertation on the Spanish Civil War and international brigades, you know, I really enjoy that seminar. Maybe I could look more into that. And then I guess kind of expanded that way. I did a pandemic master's on La Revista Blanca because it's digitized, but also for lots of other reasons, which I guess I'll probably talk about later. And then, you know, in my PhD research, wanted to expand more into some of the themes that came up during that master's degree in terms of the relationship between sort of women's emancipation and anarchism's other kind of revolutionary projects in Spain.
Two fascinating and important subjects, and we are going to speak with both of you in a bit more depth about your studies and you know, the kind of the things that you're looking at and finding out. But, you know, one of the many reasons that we wanted to ask you both on, and both on together really, was the recent symposium that you put on on Iberian anarchism, so predominantly Spain and Portugal. And unlike Danny, unfortunately, I couldn't be there. So I missed out on what looked like a really fascinating day. And I wondered if you could share with me and our listeners, you know, what kind of drew you towards putting on a conference? Why this sort of event? And if there were any sort of major themes through the day or any particular topics that emerged that really interested you?
We're obviously both at the University of Leeds, and both of us have a supervisor each in the School of History and the School of Languages. And at Leeds, there's kind of a bit of a history of the history of Spanish anarchism. We've had a kind of sequence of PhD students, possibly starting with you, Danny, but there may have been people before you too. So I think kind of capitalizing on that, and the fact that there is, at least in name, an Iberian anarchism research group based at Leeds, we decided to organize this conference. Also, we both kind of spent a large chunk of our academic careers in pandemic mode and had met a lot of people virtually or just encountered them on Twitter and that kind of thing, but not had a chance to do an in-person event. So it was a really good opportunity to do that. And in terms of the question of kind of topics and themes, I think for me, one of the big ones that emerged was hybridity. So it was actually the first panel of the day was, I think, hybridity, transnationality and anarchism, I think was the name of it. So it included Arturo Zofman Rodriguez talking about communist syndicalism and the kind of development of a synthesis between Bolshevik Marxism and anarchism. Alex Doyle, who's just finishing his master's by research at Leeds, who's talking about kind of nationalism, anti-imperialism and cosmopolitanism and anarchism in Cuba and the Cuban independence struggle and the kind of dynamics and tensions there. Then later we also had Henry Brown talking about the development of a military culture or the militarization of the anarchist militia during the Spanish Civil War, which also involved the kind of process of negotiation and hybridity. And also our keynote speaker, who is Professor Pamela Beth Radcliffe, spoke about her latest project, which is about traditions of municipalism. So that also involves a kind of looking at the overlaps between anarchism and other traditions of republican, federal, local municipalism. I found that particularly interesting because they all kind of link to international relations. I think the topic of hybridity does link closely to international relations. So all of those talks involve talking about a kind of response to global event or the tensions between the theory of cosmopolitanism at the heart of anarchism and the reality of a nation-based international order, adaptation to the international situation in the Spanish Civil War, and also the kind of symbols of global anarchism. For when we talk about municipalism, for example, there's a big link with the Paris Commune. So for me, that was probably the most interesting theme that came out. And the term hybridity, and I think Professor Radcliffe also used the term liminality, they're terms that I hadn't really used before in my research, but I think since the symposium, I've kind of been considering them more as useful concepts to engage with.
I found that aspect really interesting too. I also found it useful. I think there was a conversation towards the end about sort of within this context of hybridity, especially ideological hybridity, about anarchism being, I can't remember who said it, someone said it, anarchism being frayed at the edges, I think, which I found a really interesting framing, which kind of then relates back to my own research in terms of how a lot of people probably experienced anarchism not so much as like a closed movement, but as one aspect of, you know, something that's negotiated with other political ideas and other practices, which then affects, for example, the idea of anarchism as an identity that intersects with other identities. So when I look at anarchist womanhood, I'm almost looking at how anarchist women's identities as women and as anarchists were kind of having to be negotiated with one another, which is something I hadn't really thought about in that way until we had these conversations in the symposium. And I mean, I obviously found some of the papers that addressed gender history quite interesting. So, I mean, Henry Brown's already been mentioned, but he also spoke about kind of military masculinities and the idea of military discipline being seen as emasculizing in anarchist discussions of that within the press, for example. And also Charlotte Byrne gave a really interesting paper, which was on queer identities within anarchism. And her approach was really interesting to contribute to the whole day as a whole as well, because she's not writing a PhD in the way that the rest of us are. She's writing essentially a historical novel as her PhD project. And so bringing that perspective of somebody that's trying to write this history in a sort of public facing way with the mission of introducing the history that we are all so fascinated by, but to a sort of a public British audience, I thought was a really interesting perspective to have present on the day as well. Agreeing with Josh mostly, but I also thought it's important that we kind of had representation of historiography from Portugal and from Spain in all of the panels as well, which kind of led to really interesting conversations. And I think it meant that a lot of the papers were kind of addressing that too. For example, I think Diogo's paper, Diogo Duarte did a paper on city development in Portugal and its relationship with anarchism. And he often drew links to how his contribution to the historiography kind of paralleled a lot of developments in historiography of Spanish anarchism too, about kind of associating it with the modern, away from this idea of primitive sort of apolitical narratives of what, well, the narrative that anarchism is kind of primitive or apolitical rather than being a modern political movement, essentially a social justice movement.
Absolutely. Sounds fascinating. And I really like this theme that you both picked out about hybridity and the frayed nature of anarchism. It sounds like a great date. Can I ask, just because I know that quite a lot of sort of younger scholars listen to the show and you know, they might be thinking of doing something similar. I'd just be interested to know like how you found the experience of organizing and running an event like this.
One thing which was very encouraging, well, exciting for us and hopefully encouraging for younger researchers who are interested in this subject area is we actually succeeded in getting sponsored by the Arts and Humanities Research Council and the Past and Present Society, which are two quite fairly prestigious kind of UK-based historical organisations. And we actually got further offers of funding that we had to turn down because we already had more than enough to cover our budget, which I think is very interesting for all the people in the room here who are interested in the history of Spanish anarchism, because it shows the kind of interest that this topic can generate. And, you know, we were really happy with how many people attended. We had people from, because it was a hybrid event, so we were online as well as in person. So we were able to have people from North and South America, as well as Spain, Portugal, and different parts of the UK. So that was also really exciting. So I think, although it was a lot of work putting it together, I think it was a really rewarding experience on the whole. And I think that from what I've, my experiences over the course of my PhD, kind of anarchist history and radical history more generally tend to have quite a nice academic community. People are, generally speaking, quite you know, willing to engage and help out and engage in different forms of kind of academic mutual aid to an extent. and I think that kind of collegial, to use a very university term, atmosphere was really at the forefront during the day. We had some really nice discussions, and both formal and informal. So I was really happy with how it went.
Yeah, I completely agree. Yeah, it was, it is like a lot of work to organize it. But I think to be honest, a lot of that probably came partly from the fact that Josh and I hadn't organized anything like that before. So it was, you know, every aspect was a learning curve. And now if either of us were to organize something else, you know, in the future, it would be less daunting and less stressful. And also because neither of us had been to an in-person academic event before ourselves. So a lot of the kind of organizational process was almost learning what the event was supposed to look like in the having, you know, in the first place before you even try and actually realize that and take the steps necessary to realize that. So I think hopefully as sort of more hybrids rather than purely online events are starting to happen, I think it's a step in the right direction. I mean, hopefully the hybrid aspect can continue as well, because it was really cool to have people tuning in from all parts of Europe and even Brazil and places like, you know, all sorts of different places. And it really just opened up the conversation a lot more than it would have been able to if it was just purely in person.
subsequently you've like both published these really interesting articles. So wanted to take advantage of that to have a conversation about each of them. So we're going to start by talking about Josh's article, which is about Spanish anarchist responses to the Mexican Revolution in its early years and expressions of solidarity that came from the Spanish revolutionary movement. This is a really interesting topic. The article itself is really fascinating. So Josh, if you perhaps want to start by telling listeners where they might be able to get hold of this article, where they can read it, but also how was it that Spanish anarchists got to hear about the Mexican Revolution? So they're trying to like express solidarity with an event that's happening, across an ocean. What are their sources of information for what was happening?
The article, it's quite a short article. It was published in the journal of my kind of PhD funding organization. So it's a PhD student run journal called the Roca Journal, WROCAH. And it's open access. In terms of how Spanish anarchists kind of came into contact with the Mexican Revolution, on a very kind of practical level, it's a very good example of the level of interconnectedness of the international anarchist movement. So in Los Angeles, the organizing junta of the Mexican Liberal Party, which is kind of the main anarchist organization that's active in the early stages of the Mexican Revolution, they publish a newspaper called Regeneración, and this newspaper gets distributed around the world through networks of migrant workers or just print networks between activists in different countries. So in Spain, that they receive copies of this newspaper Regeneración, and that's kind of the basic source material, and the newspaper Regeneración promotes an interpretation of the Mexican Revolution, which in the language of the kind of political culture of the Mexican Revolution is known as Magonismo, because it's associated with Ricardo Flores Magón, who was the leader of the organizing junta. And basically it's argument in favor of a kind of social revolution, which will overthrow political leaders, do away with the state and establish kind of autonomous communities which will kind of redistribute the land fairly. In other words, it's a Mexicanized version of anarchism. So that's the kind of basic interpretation that they receive. So they copies of Regeneración are distributed in the streets of Spain, in Barcelona, Sabadell, and other anarchist strongholds. And also articles from Regeneración are republished in the anarchist press in Spain. And also leading figures in Spanish anarchism write their own contributions based on their reading of Regeneración. So my argument in the article is that on top of this kind of direct connection between the organizing junta and the workers in Spain who are reading their press, there's also a process of interpretation through the kind of language and symbology of the international anarchist movement. So I comment on things like the kind of rhetoric and discourse. So even the slogan that the Mexican Liberal Party promotes during the Mexican Revolution is Tierra y Libertad, which is obviously the title of the main anarchist newspaper at the time in Spain. They refer a lot to the idea of social revolution, la revolución social, as opposed to the political revolution, which is also an important idea in anarchism at this time, that in Spain at this time is the main kind of argument that they're pushing, that the idea of social revolution, which is the idea of a kind of popular revolution which will overthrow the state and overthrow forms of government and establish a libertarian communist form of organizing economic and social life. And then there's also in the coverage of the Mexican Revolution, there's constant references to the historical memory of the movement. So things like the Paris Commune and links to the kind of imagined geography of the movement. So they talk a lot about Yankee imperialism, and they mention kind of previous episodes like Cuba, for example, where US intervention in the Cuban War of Independence was very controversial for anarchists because a lot of them had invested quite a lot of hope in that War of Independence, because there was such an important anarchist element within the Cuban resistance to Spanish colonialism. all of these discursive and historical and geographic symbols lead to the Spanish anarchists interpreting the Mexican Revolution as the social revolution, the proof that kind of popular direct action is going to succeed and is going to prove that you don't need a political revolution. So they present it as a kind of real world challenge to the arguments of the Marxists and the Republicans.
Fascinating. It is such a fascinating topic and one that I have a great interest in. Taking anarchism and making it Mexican, I guess, in that revolution, and then it's coming back to Spain again. All of that. One aspect that I'd like to sort of talk a bit more about is this idea of solidarity and what that means in this context. Like, to what extent, you talk about discursive sort of exchanges. Is that what solidarity meant, or was there a more organized expression of solidarity? And if so, how was that sort of coordinated? How was that manifest?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I'm in my research, I'm kind of trying to think about solidarity in broader terms. So I'm quite interested in, for example, the work of David Featherstone, who's a political geographer who I mentioned in the article. And he, for example, particularly emphasizes the kind of emotional and affective dimensions of solidarity, in this case, kind of invoking the universal importance and significance and relevance of the Mexican revolutionary struggle and kind of appealing to Spanish workers that they should be more invested in it because this is their moment, and also kind of invoking the idea of the duty of revolutionary solidarity and the duty to support the Mexican revolutionaries. And then in terms of actual practical activism, the press coverage, so both Solidaridad Obrera, which is the main syndicalist newspaper, and Tierra y Libertad, which is the main anarchist one, they cover the Mexican Revolution on their front pages. And they also, each of them, start their own solidarity funds, which are raising money to support the organizing junta of the Mexican Liberal Party. And each of those two newspapers receive thousands of individual donations. And then there's actually quite a bit of a literature now emerging on solidarity funds and kind of the idea that for a lot of workers who weren't necessarily capable of making political arguments or writing articles or anything like that, being able to donate to a cause which had been very well articulated in the press by other activists was a form of speaking and acting in its own right. So yeah, the press and the print networks are very important in terms of organizational solidarity. And in 1915, a new newspaper, Reivindicación, which is an explicitly Magonista newspaper, kind of explicitly pro-Mexican Liberal Party, is established in Sabadell with logistical support from the editors of Tierra y Libertad, and that kind of continues to make the case for the case in favor of the Mexican Revolution as a kind of anarchist libertarian revolution. So again, the organizational role of the newspapers. I've not seen any evidence of anything like a Mexico Solidarity Committee or anything like that, but the CNT's first Congress does send a fraternal greeting to the Mexican revolutionaries, and the CNT has pledged to moral and material support. The revolution kind of coincides with the foundation of the CNT, and as you know, the CNT is very quickly kind of almost smothered, actually almost disappears and doesn't come back in its early years because of repression. So there's not so much that the CNT can actually do to support the Mexican Revolution, but you do see anarchist groups advertising in the newspapers saying that they'd be keen to meet with other like-minded groups who are also interested in the struggle of our brothers in Mexico. There's a really good article in Tierra Gallega describing a meeting in solidarity with the Mexican revolutionaries in A Coruña, in Galicia, organized by the local Federation of Solidaridad Obrera. So the article really describes the scene, and it talks about how they were raising money there, and it describes the speeches that are made. And I thought that was really interesting as well, because that's a really important moment in the formation of the anarcho-syndicalist movement in Galicia. It's kind of only just getting started. So between that and the anarchist groups wanting to meet like-minded Mexico supporters, I kind of suggest that that this might mean that an international event, an exciting international event like the Mexican Revolution, could be a really important kind of spark which gets people interested and brings them to the meetings, and then from there you have the development of an organization.
Yeah, that's really interesting and persuasive as an interpretation. The article also though hints at tantalizingly at subsequent controversy among the international anarchist movement with regard to the Mexican Revolution. So I was wondering if you could elaborate on that for us.
Yeah, so quite a limited word count on the article, and I wanted to focus on the topic of the construction of solidarity, the kind of building blocks. But yeah, shortly after these kind of early months of just a general solidarity movement in favor of Mexico, a split does develop. One of the first things that happens is that the organizing junta calls for its international allies to come and visit Baja California, the region in Mexico, where they claim that kind of libertarian communism is in the process of being established, and that these anarchists should come and see it for themselves and join in and support the efforts. And a few Italian anarchists from the kind of New Jersey, New York area actually take up the offer, and they're very unimpressed with what they find. Basically, there's quite a lot of sometimes very conflicting accounts of what actually happens in Baja California, but the long and short is that there's never a kind of coordinated, generalized movement in favor of anarchism in Baja California. And it's quite likely that there were American soldiers of fortune and even kind of corporate mercenaries potentially involved in basically challenging the authority of the new Mexican revolutionary government there, you know, in order to take advantage of the situation. So basically that there isn't a process of libertarian communism being established. These Italians go back to New York and New Jersey quite disappointed, and Luigi Galliano, who's one of the leading figures among these Italian anarchists, describes the revolution in Baja California as a rivoluzione de tavolino, which is literally like a coffee table revolution, but which my Italian friends have informed me is like a fantasy revolution, like a wishful thinking revolution. So he begins to kind of propagate that view from his newspaper, and it's taken up by other people, by other anarchists, including Jean Crave, who's one of the leading figures in the international movement in France. And they kind of start arguing that actually the Mexican Liberal Party is a scam, really, and that Ricardo Flores Magón and his allies in Los Angeles, they're just living in Los Angeles. They're not participating in the revolution. There is no proper anarchist presence in the revolution, and that they're just kind of receiving solidarity funds for themselves. And then what also happens is that it just becomes more and more apparent that the organizing junta's original efforts to paint the Mexican Revolution as a kind of very much an anarchist-led effort at establishing libertarian communism is not really accurate. The Mexican Revolution is a very complex process. It spans from kind of wealthy elites who just want to reestablish constitutional norms and get rid of the Porfirio Diaz dictatorship, to peasants and indigenous communities rising for land reform. There are anarchists active in the revolution, but it's not an anarchist-led revolution. And some maybe more traditionalist anarchists are not convinced and are unwilling to support this, because they just see it as a kind of materialist pursuit of land reform rather than an attempt to establish anarchy. And then during the First World War, this ends up kind of tied to the pro-allied minority, the Francophiles. So I think Jim mentions in his book that this Francophilia can be kind of linked to some of these anarchists, these more traditional anarchists' proximity to 19th century republicanism and federalism and very kind of Enlightenment ideas of building a kind of a rational, yeah, Enlightenment-based future. So then they're not particularly interested in Mexican indigenous peasants, and quite a lot of racism creeps into some of their criticisms of the revolution. And in Spain, they're kind of represented by El Porvenir del Obrero, which is a newspaper based in Mahon in Mallorca, and Acción Libertaria in Gijón, and they kind of suggest that the fact that some anarchists are celebrating what they see as kind of a backwards materialist movement by indigenous Mexican peasants, and also its de facto Germanophilia in the First World War, because the anarchist majority doesn't support the Allies. They see these two things as kind of related and kind of common shared symptoms of the failures of anarchist education and propaganda, and the failure to properly teach people what anarchism means. Probably the most interesting exception here is Kropotkin, because he's obviously one of the best known of parts of this Francophile pro-Allied minority, but he's also very sympathetic to the Mexican Revolution and the idea that Mexican indigenous people could actually be practitioners of a very pure form of mutual aid and communism. So it ties in with his own anthropological and geographical views. This defense is represented in Spain by Reivindicación, the newspaper that I mentioned before, which argues against those newspapers. It defends the Mexican Revolution. It defends the potential of Mexican indigenous peasants to establish libertarian communism, sometimes drawing on its own kind of orientalist and slightly problematic ideas, but it defends them. And it also defends anti-militarism and argues against joining the First World War on either side or supporting either side, and also criticizes the kind of intellectual snobbery of the Francophiles and the critics of the Mexican Revolution. And instead of their kind of intellectual perspective, it defends the idea of a very active, militant, direct action form of anarchism. So those are the two sides of this kind of controversy.
Thanks very much, Josh. That was a really fascinating sort of summary of your article there and some of the themes in it. And, you know, I hope we can have you back on, you know, further along down your studies and talk some more. But we're going to bring in Sophie now as well and talk about Sophie's recent article, which looks at anarchist approaches to sexuality and gender, focusing in particular on one key publication in that sort of milieu. So, yeah, can we begin by introducing your main source material, La Revista Blanca, and in particular, its advice columns from which you draw some of this fascinating research?
So the article is published with Contemporary European History, and it's also open access. In the article, which is based on my master's research on La Revista Blanca, as you said, looks specifically at the advice columns. So to kind of introduce the magazine itself, it was a magazine published by the Montseny family beginning in 1898. So this family was made up essentially of Juan Montseny, who went by the alias Federico Urales, his partner Teresa Manier, who went by Soledad Gustavo, and the two of them set up the newspaper in 1898, as I said. At the time, Federico was, he'd been exiled and kind of smuggled himself back to Spain, so the newspaper was set up under Soledad's name, and they kind of, at the time, made quite a big deal out of the fact that it was one of the few publications run by a woman, although, I mean, circumstances played a role in that, I think. They publish until 1905, at which point Soledad Gustavo gives birth to Federica Montseny, their daughter, and they stop publishing, and then they restart publishing again in 1923 until 1936, by which point Federica, the daughter, is, I think she's 18-ish around 1923, and she starts to become one of their main writers as well. She has her own sort of columns and things. And in the 1930s, when her father gets sick, she takes over a lot of the kind of administrative and leadership roles within the publishing house as well. And Federica Montseny is, I think, relatively well known as one of the anarchists that enters the government in 1936 as a minister within that Civil War Republican government context. The magazine, it was a long form publication. It was on the more expensive side compared to some of the other anarchist publications at the time. And so it wasn't, in terms of readership and stuff, it wasn't necessarily one of the most widely bought, but it was one of the most well known. It's referred to a lot in other publications that would respond to it. It also had correspondence based in all sorts of places in Europe and Latin America, and it was distributed. Even though it was published from Madrid and then later Barcelona, it was distributed elsewhere in Spain and Europe and Latin America too. Although it wasn't necessarily like because of its the fact that it was long form and had, you know, it was quite a chunky publication and therefore more expensive to print and to sell, it was still considered quite a significant magazine. That was, it, you know, it was, the family were well known and the magazine itself was well known too. And so, like, with my gender history hat on, I suppose, there are a few things that kind of drew me to this publication in particular. One of those things is that it was one of the anarchist publications that published the most articles by women. Historians that have kind of looked at, you know, women in the anarchist press in a more sort of quantitative way have pointed to La Revista Blanca as an example of that. It also had a lot of articles on more sort of lifestyle kind of themes. They talk a lot, it would talk a lot about things like naturism and beauty and, you know, social relations between the sexes and medicine and things like that, that spoke to a lot of the themes that I was interested in learning about in the context of sort of anarchist discourse in the 20s and 30s. So I found that particularly useful. And then also it had these advice columns, which I just thought were a fascinating insight into the sort of conversations that were happening within the anarchist movement, essentially. And although there were other anarchist periodicals that did have advice columns, I've seen some in like Inicialis and Estudios, for example, La Revista Blanca had really quite extensive ones in the early 1930s. You know, they were often several pages long. The questions were answered by a mixture of, you know, the editorial team, the Monsignies, and an anarchist doctor that they recruited to answer the kind of more specifically medical questions. His name was Dr. Javier Serrano, but he called himself Dr. Klug, which means clever in German, Dr. Clever. These advice columns essentially are the primary source material that I looked at specifically for the article, and the thing that I thought would be most intriguing about what came out of my master's research.
You know that Juan Monsen spent the night in Liverpool?
Oh, really?
people know, yeah. He was arrested as part of the Montjuic, the famous like Montjuic trials after the Corpus Christi bombing. And he was going to be deported to the Gold Coast along with like several other anarchists. And there was an international campaign to stop him from being deported there. So they said, okay, but we have to deport you somewhere. Where do you want to go? And so they went, France. And they're like, well, you can't go there. You're going to England. And then so they got sent to Liverpool. So he spent the night in Kensington at the headquarters of the Independent Labour Party there. And then after, like, they'd been given like food and, like, you know, been regaled with speeches and things, at the end of the night, everybody present sang God Save the King. Yeah, the Spanish anarchists were like, this is a weird country. So what was the anarchist sexual revolution then, Sophie? And what was distinctive about how Spanish anarchists approached this, the question of like sexuality in that particular period?
As a lot of people have written about, not least Nat Andrews, who you guys all know, anarchism was that the revolution began with the everyday, right? It was holistic. It was about transforming every aspect of your life. And it was also prefigurative. So it was about living an anarchist life now in preparation for the revolution and preparing the people to be able to live this lifestyle. That meant that essentially people's personal lives, including their relationships, their dating life, their sex life, was all really on the table as something that needed to be figured out and have its own anarchist principles. And so, yeah, essentially sex was taken very seriously within the anarchist movement by publications like La Revista Blanca and also others as well. And so that's kind of what I mean by the sexual revolution, is like an aspect of the anarchist revolution essentially that was taken seriously. It was by no means sort of a homogenous thing that everyone agreed on, but there were some kind of key strains within that that were kind of core ideological tenets. So one was opposition to marriage. That didn't mean that there weren't anarchists that didn't get married for whatever reason, but at least ideologically speaking, the anarchists were anti-clerical, so they weren't going to agree to, you know, partnerships blessed by God. But also more fundamentally, they were opposed to just really the idea that there should be an authority figure coercing couples to remain together against their will, right? And so, yeah, opposition to marriage was a key tenet. Some anarchists reframed partnerships around so-called free unions instead, which were kind of secular commitment ceremonies in a way. A lot of them happened under the auspices of trade unions during the Civil War. But then there were other anarchists that thought that even that was essentially the same as marriage, and that partnership should be free to come together and end without anybody, any third party involved. The other key tenet was sex for pleasure, essentially. So the divorcing of reproductive sex from sex for pleasure. Although that's where a lot of the complications start to begin, because at the time, in the 20s and 30s is the period I look at, early 1930s for in the case of my article specifically, the sort of contraceptive options available are not the same as today. And so the idea of sexual liberation, meaning total freedom to sleep with whoever you want, didn't necessarily equate to emancipation of women in a sort of direct way, because a lot of contraceptive options at the time were either expensive or medically risky to women. And so that's where this idea of what is sexually liberating or oppressive becomes less clear cut. And then you kind of add on top of that other complications. So topics like sex work, masturbation, homosexuality, on top of these two key strands, those then add further complications into what kind of the parameters of an anarchist sexual morality might be. Another thing that I then kind of add into the article, drawing on the work of, for example, Richard Clemenson, our mine and Josh's supervisor, is that, anarchism's views on sexuality aren't, in a vacuum. They're also coexisting and interacting with other, essentially, crises in gender, in masculinity and femininity, and in sexuality in the 1920s and 30s, to do with two key schools of thought, one being eugenics and the other being Neo-Malthusianism. So eugenics being the idea that the society is degenerating in some way, and that's down to certain people passing on certain characteristics genetically through sexual encounters. And so, there are anarchists that are very much wanting to use the opportunity to reshape sexual morality as a way of addressing that problem, or that perceived problem. And then on the other hand, there's Neo-Malthusians who believe that populations are out of control, and that's kind of the root of a lot of social ills. And so there should be more education and limits placed on sexual encounters through encouraging use of contraception, for example, and abortion, in order to limit the size of populations, which often ends up, as we know, in wanting to limit certain populations more so than others. And so there's that conversation too between anarchism and Neo-Malthusianism, and some anarchists are more affiliated with one than the other, and that again makes more complicated this idea of sexual morality. And so essentially what I'm trying to say in the article is, I guess we often kind of inherently assume that anarchism means kind of total permissiveness in terms of sexuality. It's all free love, it's all kind of do what you want. But actually it's the reshaping of a new morality around sexuality, redefining boundaries and limits. They're just, somewhat different to those in mainstream society or bourgeois society or Catholic society.
That's brilliant. So, you've done really well there to give a sense of a massive, topic. I thoroughly empathize with, some of the things you said there about it being, it is complicated. It is about a constant defining and redefining. And that really neatly, I think, comes back to the advice columns themselves. And you describe them as a conversation. And I think this links back actually to something Josh was talking about as well, about, the discursive way that solidarity is kind of enacted through the press and that those conversations, basically. And even back to the beginning of the podcast, when we were talking about the fluidity and hybridity of anarchism, and often that comes through dialogue and talking to one another. So I think, our listeners would be really interested to hear some of the examples of advice that was asked for and given in these columns. And what they might suggest in a broader picture about what you've just spoken about, really, the kind of the aims of, but also the limits of an anarchist critique of patriarchal society of that time.
And I just wanted to add that I totally do see it as a conversation, because I think it's easy to see something like an advice column as essentially two voices, a question and an answer. But actually what's interesting when you kind of look through them all across time is that you see someone will ask a question about a certain topic, and then in the next issue there's like four questions on that same topic because people are like, oh, that's something we can talk about, like, oh, that's something that actually is interesting to me too, I want to know about that. And so it does actually build in a more sort of continuous way. So yeah, definitely a conversation is how I see it. But yeah, in terms of some examples of sort of what was asked and answered, one of the first things that really struck me was the frequency with which health problems relating specifically to women came up within La Revista Blanca, you know, things to do with periods, with miscarriages. You know, this is a, you know, a chunky political magazine aimed at men and women. Most of its articles are either talking about, you know, lifestyle stuff, or they're talking about, you know, the revolution and anarchist economics and stuff. And then you go to the advice columns and it's questions that you would order, like, normally associate with like a women's magazine, like an agony aunt column, something like that. So that really struck me, that, you know, women had a voice here to express experiences, often quite painful or traumatic experiences that societally were kind of almost taboo. And actually the fact that this was recognized too. So in one of the responses, Dr. Klug, the anarchist doctor who responds to them, he actually said, you know, I actually can't answer this very well because there has not enough research on this topic. And that's because of essentially government and bourgeois morality that's limiting the amount of knowledge that we're generating about this area of, like, sort of women's menstrual cycles and hormones and things, blaming the stigmatization of these topics for the fact that he kind of can't provide a good answer. So actually calling that out, I thought, was really interesting. It's, you know, not a cause within the anarchist movement that, you know, necessarily comes up a lot, but so I found it quite interesting just to read it. Another theme that comes up in terms of, you know, critiquing patriarchal society, as you put it, is virginity. So in the advice columns, it's made abundantly clear that anarchists do not believe that virginity is a thing. It's rebutted several times that, you know, you can't tell whether a woman has had sex based on examining her genitalia, that that's just not a way that you can tell, you know, that information. And the massive criticism of kind of the culture of purity around what is essentially a false diagnosis. You know, that critique does come from anti-clericalism, obviously, but also more generally, it connects to this idea that, you know, women should be unburdened and unstigmatized and unashamed to have sexual desires and enter relationships freely without kind of added pressure. And then tied to that, something that is quite, that comes up again quite a lot in responses to people's questions, is that often when men write in with kind of dating dilemmas about, you know, what if my girlfriend does such and such or whatever, the responses are almost always saying, you know, be careful, like, women are, you know, socioeconomically disadvantaged in the society we currently live in. That won't be the case in the future, but, you know, after the revolution, but right now, like, don't take advantage of your girlfriend, because if you break up with her, like, she won't have the same necessarily easy access to find employment and be financially independent like you do. And again, when it comes to virginity, you know, men are being told specifically, like, you shouldn't care if your girlfriend's a virgin, because you're not. It's a double standard. And so the advice given to men also kind of does address this patriarchal societal situation, which I thought interesting too. It's not just put on women to solve these problems, it's also, you know, put on the men. And I guess the last thing that comes up absolutely loads in the advice columns that really interested me is, like, contraception and abortion, you know, sex education stuff. And that's where it gets a bit more tricky, because it's one of the more controversial topics that people, you know, different individuals within the anarchist movement have their own personal views on this. Federica Monsegni is very much of the view that if you try and encourage the people, especially the working classes, to use contraception, you're going to shrink the proletariat, which is going to damage the revolution. So she's not really a fan. She, I think there's an article elsewhere in La Revista Blanca where she discusses, like, essentially menstrual tracking and kind of using that as your way to avoid getting pregnant. On the other side of things, there's anarchists like Isaac Puente, who wrote for Estudios, a different magazine, who was very much, like, pro-contraception, campaigning that, you know, abortion should be made, should be a reasonable you know, a reasonable thing to turn to. And then in the middle, you've got Dr. Klug, who's, yeah, ideologically in the middle, you've got him, who's the doctor who's actually at answering the questions at La Revista Blanca. And he, at least in my interpretation of sort of the way he writes about these topics, he is comfortable advising people who ask about what best contraception to use. From his sort of medical opinion, and he's definitely more pro use of contraception rather than abortion. He sort of sees contraception as a way to not have to turn to abortion, or at least not as often. Although he's not sort of, his opposition to abortion isn't necessarily like in a sort of pro-life way. It's more that, you know, at the time it's a risky procedure. A lot of women don't have it surgically. They do it to themselves, which carries huge risk. So it's more sort of on the medical side that he's having that view. But essentially, a lot of people write in saying, you know, what sort of contraception should I use? Or I tried this contraception, it didn't work. What should I do differently? Or someone's told me that this thing works. What do you think? And he'll give them detailed answers. So it's essentially a resource for sex education. Like, even if you weren't one of the people writing in to the magazine, you would still read, you could still read these pages and get a load of information about how to prevent pregnancy, and also how to prevent sexually transmitted diseases as well. That's one of the more controversial topics within the magazine, I think, in terms of its relationship to patriarchy and to the emancipation of women. I wouldn't say in La Revista Blanca it's framed necessarily in a kind of reproductive autonomy, emancipation of women kind of way. It's more in a pragmatic kind of way, and to some extent in a eugenic way when it comes to people writing in terms of like fear of passing on inherited illnesses and stuff like that. They're kind of advised to use contraception so as to not pass on. Whereas in other magazines like Iniciales or Estudios, it's much more about reproductive autonomy and kind of the principle of having that freedom over your body. And it is more connected to the emancipation of women specifically. Whereas La Revista Blanca doesn't portray it so much in that way.
And I suppose like one of the ways that both of your research interests or like seem to speak to one another is in like these moments of like possible like tension or contradiction within like anarchist understandings of, say, like science and progress and things like this. And, you know, eugenics is a really exemplary case of where a lot of anarchists who think that they're just responding to the latest scientific information, And as they tended to do, sort of glorifying that supposed scientific or medical progress somewhat uncritically, evidently like overlaps with like problems of racism that are evoked in both like Josh's talk and which were, you know, potential problems. I mean, I don't know if that's something that you came across, Sophie, like racism specifically in La Revista Blanca, but I know that Monsen parents at least were, I think, on record as having like basically racist or like civilizational views in terms of their attitudes towards non-Europeans.
What you said about kind of anarchism and science, I think, is super interesting, because I mean, something that I was thinking on and writing about more recently is the kind of relationship between anarchism and science, essentially, and its connection to relationship between anarchism and sort of authority or expertise, establishment. Because I think it is actually quite a bit more complicated. There's a lot of interventions in the anarchist press that deal with science or medicine are kind of managing to be anti-establishment medicine, but kind of pro-modern science in certain ways. But then there are kind of pinpoint things like vaccination, for example, where there's a very anti-medicine, anti-science stance. But then on things like eugenics, or I guess sort of contraceptive medicine, there's somewhat more willingness to be open-minded to that. So I think it's actually, again, another kind of point of complication, which could probably take a whole podcast episode to unravel. In terms of relationship between sort of the discourses that Josh and I look at in our research and racism and colonialism, empire and such like, I think in terms of the discussions of gender, women's emancipation, there's actually kind of two ways in which that interacts with racism or orientalism, exoticism and such like. So one is actually kind of admiration for certain, you know, quote unquote primitive societies that are, you know, uninhibited by modern Western consumerist capitalist institutions such as marriage, and who live more, you know, freely, almost in an aspirational, a way that's aspirational to the anarchists, you know, this idea of kind of the noble savage, you know, the aspirational primitive society. But then at the same time, there are definite ideas about civilizational hierarchy and kind of the desire to rid Spain and society in general of social degeneration, whatever that means in terms of its kind of ableist, racist, you know, whatever else kind of intersections. So those two things kind of coexist. And I mean, there is a class element to that too in La Revista Blanca. Something I've, I guess, I think I forgot to mention at the beginning is, you know, the Monsigny family are kind of essentially middle class. They're not down with the workers, kind of authentically proletarian anarchist fighters. They are more of a sort of middle class family. And that is a point of tension that they have with other anarchists. And, you know, ideologically, they're more sort of aligned with kind of communal anarchism as opposed to syndical anarchism, which again creates tension. And so you can see that kind of play out in the way that someone like Federico Monsigny discusses women's emancipation. It then has kind of classist and racist undertones in some of her sort of column pieces on that topic, where she kind of sees most women as not being ready for emancipation. Most women are, you know, not dignified enough, they're not living their lives well enough, they're not not intelligent enough to become part of this anarchist and gender emancipation revolution. And she sees herself as kind of above them and like a vanguard to educate them and make that, you know, spread the revolution top down, which isn't necessarily something that most anarchists at the time would have been on board with ideologically. And that obviously would then have implications in terms of comparative civilization discourses about, you know, the what's civilized and what's uncivilized.
I was thinking in Sophie's work, there's a kind of tension, the tensions kind of that I perceive as between the kind of fundamental idea of the autonomy of the individual and freedom that's at the heart of anarchism, and the kind of aspiration for kind of improving society, which is represented by the support for scientific ideas and in turn eugenics and neo-Malthusian ideas. And in my case, in my research, I think there can be a tension there between a very basic fundamental principle of solidarity, which again, similar to autonomy and individual freedom, is so it kind of it's a principle, and it's also a kind of an affect, and a lot of the anarchists' own reflections on what solidarity is refer a lot to kind of it being a basic an emotion and really intimately tied to the sentiments. So you have that on the one hand, and on the other hand you have kind of aspirations and ideas of, you know, what a good society will actually look like, and those two things can obviously come into conflict when it comes to international relations and international solidarity, because time after time you have a process of something happens somewhere in the world and the anarchists in Spain are like, this is our revolution, these are our allies, and then as more information comes through, it becomes clearer that wasn't exactly the case, and that the revolution happening elsewhere doesn't look exactly like what they'd kind of like it to look like, which can then lead to tension. That's exactly what happens with the Russian Revolution. At the beginning, it's pretty much interpreted by Spanish anarchists as the kind of embodiment of their own idea of a revolution. And then in the subsequent months, it becomes apparent that it's actually quite a bit different to what they've been arguing. So yeah, I think that tension there is a really interesting one to get into. I guess there's a kind of reflection between each of our own projects in terms of that tension between the fundamental principle and the aspiration.
Well, that was great answers, both of you, and it's nice to sort of start after sort of starting together and then sort of going into the details of what you're doing to start sort of threading it back together again. It was a nice sort of rhythm to it. I think we should use the opportunity to ask you guys if there was anything else that you'd like to say, or, you know, ask one another.
It's not something that I've properly started getting into yet, but I want to look at the role of anarchist women in particular in Solidarity and the organization Solidaridad Internacional Antifascista during the Spanish Civil War, the International Antifascist Solidarity, which is a kind of humanitarian aid organization organized by anarchists, kind of as a political rival to International Red Aid, the communist humanitarian organization, but also to address very pressing humanitarian needs of refugees. I mean, I've looked into it a bit, and women, including prominent members of Mujeres Libres, are very much involved in founding and organizing. I think draw on, well, I've seen some of the sources that Sophie has actually shared with me from her own research, which kind of indicates to me that there is a tradition of humanitarian internationalism that appears in the pages of Mujeres Libres, for example. So I certainly hope that there's scope for the collaboration between both of our projects when I get a bit more into that part of my own research.
Likewise, in terms of the order that I'm currently planning to kind of address different themes within my PhD research, to like further in the future, I am planning to look into things like involvement of women in circulation of press and development of correspondence relationships, for example, between anarchists in Spain and in the Americas. And so again, like there's a transnational element to my research on anarchist women and womanhood and identity. So another point of intersection essentially between mine and Josh's research.
Yeah, I do actually talk very, very briefly on the question of gender in this article, because the meeting in A Coruña that I mentioned before, that's very described in great detail by Tierra Gallega, it kind of refers to it refers very explicitly to the presence of women at the meeting, as if it's like really important to acknowledge that they're there. And it mentions that at the doorway, I think, of the meeting, there's a collection plate being staffed by two younger girls. And then during one of the speeches, someone insists that a couple of the women present should kind of take a donation plate around and collect further funds. Yeah, there's already a kind of element there of women being involved and visible, but kind of there's a clear gendering of roles. I mean, there's a whole series of male speakers, and then the women are kind of handing around the collection plate. I am kind of in the process of gathering more source material, which will enable me to make a more in-depth analysis of the role of women there. But I think it is, this was in 1910, 1911, when not very many women were necessarily integrated into the labour movement, or it's very much in the process of integrating women workers into the labour movement. So I think it's quite interesting that they're very visibly involved there. And also in the press coverage of the Mexican Revolution, there's a couple of articles from female revolutionaries. The Mexican Liberal Party always refers to redistributing land to men and women on without any regard to their sex. It explicitly refers to that. So I'm interested. I haven't come across any explicit responses from Spanish women kind of addressing that element of the Mexican Liberal Party propaganda, but it's an interesting point.
So when the big collaborative article comes out between you both, we'll definitely have to get you back in, and it already sounds like a very fruitful sort of avenue to explore. Yeah, just left to say thank you both for coming on and chatting about your work and about the event that you put on, which sounds like you did a tremendous job, not least, as you said earlier, that you've not actually been to an in-person academic conference before. So, that's great. Why not just make one that you want it to look like, and, you don't have to pay attention to what's gone before. I think that's the right way to go. So well done to you both, and thank you both for coming on. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this discussion. We've put links to Sophie and Josh's articles in the notes to this show, Both are available to everyone as they are open access publications. Also in the notes is a link to some reflections on the symposium we discussed at the beginning of the show, written by the organisers, Sophie and Josh. And returning to the introduction to this episode, you can find links to Bristol Defendant Solidarity and Bristol Anarchist Black Cross in the notes as well. You can keep in touch with the podcast via email, abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com, and Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, all at abcdannyandjim. You can subscribe to our newsletter at abcwithdannyandjim.substack.com. The podcast music is Stealing Orchestra and Rafael Di Nocio, Gente de Miniaterra, and the podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo. Love and solidarity. Until next time.